All right, our last case this morning is number 24-11239, Katie Wood versus the Florida Department of Education. Mr. Weir.
May it please the court, Brian Weir on behalf of the Florida State Defendants. This case raises the question of whether governments can regulate their school teachers' speech conveyed directly to their students in the classroom.
All right, here we go. Let's start out with two hypotheticals. State of Florida decides, a very different state of Florida, decides that socialism is good and that they want to protect socialism against all attacks and they want to foster socialism in the educational system. So they require all teachers to refer to themselves as comrade with regards to their students. First Amendment violation?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think everyone agrees that local school boards of the state could require teachers to go by Mr. or Mrs. instead of their first names.
Okay, next hypothetical. State decides that married women should not keep their maiden names when they get betrothed. And so the state requires that all married female teachers refer to themselves by their husband's last name, even if they've chosen to keep their maiden name after getting married. First Amendment violation?
So just so I understand the hypothetical, in class with students, they need to use their name. The First Amendment does not distinguish between those hypotheticals and requiring a teacher to go by Mr. or Mrs. in the first place. There may be other claims that the teacher could bring. But just to be clear how this...
And why are those not First Amendment violations? Because the state can make the teacher... Is it your position that a state can require a teacher to refer to himself or herself or themselves as anything in communication with students?
As anything?
Yes. I mean, I've given you two.
Sure.
I can go further.
Sure.
And extend the hypotheticals to more extreme scenarios. But I want to know if I need to, or is it your position that when it comes to the classroom, the state can dictate exactly how a teacher is to refer to himself or herself vis-a-vis students?
So two responses, if I can do two. The first I started just a moment ago. I think everyone agrees that a school board or a state can require teachers to go by Mr. or Mrs. instead of their first name in the first place. And so if that is true, if that is pursuant to a teacher's duties, what a teacher was called by students in that context, this case is just a short putt from there.
It's not. That's a long drive. That's a long drive. You can't. The First Amendment, and Judge Newsom has written about it extensively, the First Amendment is full of doctrine and cubbyholes and all sorts of stuff. And you can't go from requiring a teacher for formality purposes to refer to himself or herself as Mr. or Ms. or Mrs. as opposed to a first name basis to everything else. It's a starting point, but it's not a justification under the First Amendment.
So my second response is teachers, as a condition of becoming a teacher, are compelled to say and teach things that they disagree with to their core. The Cluj and Wiley cases, which are just the mere image of this, these are teachers who are being required to use pronouns that don't align with sex. They don't want to do that. But those school boards are requiring them to do that, and that's something that teachers have had to do for generations. For example, teachers are compelled to teach evolution, even if they don't even believe in it, if they believe in creationism. And the opposite is true. A teacher may disagree with a school's COVID policies, but it cannot criticize those policies to students. There's all sorts of things that teachers, because of their unique...
But those are curriculum-based.
Well, I disagree that they are. For example, the COVID...
You don't think evolution is curriculum-based?
That example is, but let's take the COVID policy.
And you don't think in a science class, COVID policies are curriculum-based?
I don't think they are, so let's take an algebra teacher.
A science class and you're talking about communicable diseases and viruses, and you're talking about COVID, that's not curriculum-based?
I think that in that particular example, it would be curriculum-based, but if you had an algebra teacher, for example, who disagreed with the school's COVID policies, and at the beginning of the class, the algebra teacher says, I think these COVID policies are bunk, we should be doing X, Y, and Z, and the teacher is undermining the school's message on how COVID should be dealt with. There's no way you could say that that's curricular, but of course the school must have the be able to restrict the teacher's ability to make those statements to students. And the line, I just want to be clear, there's two prongs to this analysis. The first prong is whether the speech is pursuant to a teacher's official duties. And when you're looking at that question, the line is not whether something is curricular or non-curricular. Otherwise, teachers would be able to be free to say whatever they wanted to in a classroom. They can make political positions to students. An algebra teacher could say, you know, I was watching the news yesterday, and the president, there was an attempted assassination attempt.
Yeah, but all of those hypotheticals succeed or fail at different steps of the analysis.
I'm not sure I follow.
An algebra teacher speaking about politics, right? That may be private speech in a sense, because it has nothing to do with the math lessons that the teacher is imparting on the students. It may be a matter of public concern, politics, the election, et cetera, et cetera. But when you get to balancing at the end of the day, the state is likely to win because you don't want teachers speaking about politics when they're supposed to be teaching algebra to their students. So, you know, some of the examples that, and I'm guilty of it too, so some of the examples I've used and you've used succeed or founder at different steps of the analysis. They're all not necessarily congruent.
So I think just getting to the, you're talking about getting to the Pickering analysis. I mean, the Supreme Court in Garcetti itself added the element that it's something pursuant to the official duties, specifically in part for the purpose to keep courts away from the Pickering analysis, because what was happening is you have federal courts who are balancing over and over and over again public employment decisions that are happening at work.
Can I ask you, so I think this segues into a blocking and tackling question that I have about the nature of the statute and the nature of this lawsuit. And I'll ask the other side as well. So the statute, right, applies to things that occur, interactions with students, right, and within the line and scope of employment. I'm paraphrasing. Is that right?
That's effectively correct.
And then is it true as well that this lawsuit is effectively an as-applied challenge to things occurring in the classroom?
That's correct.
So the teacher remains free to identify herself as she pleases, to correct people as she pleases in faculty meetings, maybe even, I don't know what you would say about sort of like casual interactions with students outside the classroom and extracurricular activities. Is this really just about classroom instruction?
So I want to be very clear about the record here. The district court held that this is an as-applied challenge to speech that's happening in the classroom. And that's at page 55 of the district court's opinion when there was a discussion about the scope. And that's supported by the plaintiff's declaration, which says Wood wants to put the pronouns on the whiteboard, wants to use them with students in class, and also wants to put them on syllabus. And that's all core, in our view, teacher speech that's happening in the classroom.
I do think it's important to focus on the actual speech, the syllabus, the whiteboard, and correcting students in class that use the wrong pronouns, right? So when little Timmy raises his hand and uses the wrong pronoun, the teacher says, wrong pronoun, use this, right? Was there also something about a button?
Katie Wood wears a lanyard.
A lanyard? So I understand the government speech arguments, the idea that the syllabus, the whiteboard, telling the student, you're wrong, you have to use this pronoun, all of that sounds like government speech, that the teacher is acting as a teacher. The lanyard seems a little different to me because it's just like an article of clothing. What do you say about that?
So our response is if the what the lanyard looks like is not in the record. I think it said she, her. Uh-huh. If that is conveying to students that the teachers in class, that the teacher's pronouns are she, her, and those differ from sex, then I think that is prohibited. It is speech.
Well, it may be prohibited. I guess I'm saying, is that government speech? Is it speech pursuant to the teacher's duties, right?
I think so, because if you take that example, instead of saying she, her, it said, you know, Jews out of Palestine, for example. That would be speech in the classroom happening, and of course the school would be able to regulate that type
of
speech.
Yeah, but that might be, I guess here's the issue, to go to Judge Jordan's point, that might well be something that the government can regulate and say, you're not allowed to do that. You know, we don't want students exposed to that. But wouldn't that come later in the analysis as opposed to saying that that button, lanyard, whatever, T-shirt is actually pursuant to your official duties, that speech pursuant to your official duties?
I think it is because a teacher's job, and I think this is important, we point this out in our brief, a teacher's job is different than your average public employee. This isn't a backroom clerk at City Hall. This isn't a firefighter. Mm-hmm. This is someone whose job is speech, and they have a captive audience, and that's the entire point of teaching.
What about a cross pin? So they've got a necklace that has a cross on it.
If you prohibit that type of speech, I think you run into free exercise issues.
Well, no, I'm saying the first issue is that speech pursuant to a teacher's duties?
I think it could be because that actually kind of aligns with this court's precedent in Bishop, where a teacher was interjecting religious messages while teaching. And if that was in that hypothetical, if there was some interjection of religious messages, this court held in Bishop that is the type of speech because that can be regulated for a teacher. Of course, you do run into that. You do run into free exercise problems there, which I think is.
But if it's not a cross and it's a MAGA pin.
Make America Great Again?
Yeah.
I think that's right. If it's I think both of those things could be speech depending on the context.
Well, yeah, they're both speech, but I guess the question is, are they speech under the first step here, which is really what we're talking about right now, under the first step, are they speech pursuant to a teacher's official duties such that you don't even have to get to the rest of the analysis?
I think that it is. Because what a teacher does is project a message to students, and we're talking about just in the classroom. I just want to be clear. But because if that's not something, I'm set aside the free exercise concerns, because I think there are substantial ones in that hypothetical. If you can't regulate that, then you can't regulate the Make America Great Again pen in class. They're sending a message that can be, and this was Bishop, that can be attributed to the school or the school board or the state, yeah, because of the nature of a teacher-student relationship. I see that
Can I ask you a couple of more questions? Sort of the blocking, tackling questions of Judge Newsom. Can a teacher respond to an inquiry from a student in what you would say is a prohibited way? So Timmy, after class, says, you know, You were Miss Wood for a long time. Now you're Teacher Wood. Can I still call you Miss Wood? What would her response be? What could her response be?
I think if the question is, can I call you Miss Wood? I think
yes.
Under the law,
what is she allowed to say under the statute?
I think students are allowed to call the plaintiff Miss Wood.
I know, but that's not my
question. In response, I think the way the statute's written is the teachers cannot provide. Tell a student that this is my pronoun or this is my title. So I do believe that would be covered by the statute. I mean, in the classroom context.
So if she said, call me Ms. Wood, problem. But if she says, call me what you want.
I think under the way the statute is written, I think that is, I don't think that's covered.
Okay. So, next question. Are non-educational personnel covered by the statute? I know it's an as-applied challenge, but this is for my edification.
Yes, they are.
Janitorial staff, for example?
Yes.
Even they don't deal with students?
Correct.
Man, what a crazy world.
I do want to emphasize it is an as-applied challenge from...
I get it.
Okay.
I get it. A janitor, a cafeteria worker, who sees no students... can't say that he or she or they prefer to be called by a certain pronoun.
That's correct. And again, it gets if you look at it,
even to adults.
To adults?
Yeah.
Well,
you have a meeting of the janitorial staff, and a transgender person says, you know, I've transitioned and I want to be called Ms. or Mr. whatever. You can't say that to your adult colleagues.
I'm glad you asked that question, Judge Jordan. You absolutely can. This applies only in the teacher-to-student relationship. So
no, but
or someone to student.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
The student
someone
has to be the
student.
Recipient of the message.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So your first answer was not to my question was not quite right.
I took your first question to be a janitor talking to a student.
No. That's I didn't mean to phrase it that way. And if I did, I got it wrong, and not you. Okay. So
in a non-student setting, educational personnel are able to self-identify and tell other adults how they want to be referred to.
Absolutely.
Is that on the face of the statute, or is that your reading of the statute?
It is, Your Honor. If you look at the statute, it says an employee or contractor of a public K through 12 educational institution may not provide to a student his or her preferred personal title. And I think we did explain in the brief that there's nothing restricting in the break room at the water cooler from using your pronouns. It's specifically just to students.
All right. Thank you very much. You've saved your time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Boyd.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Sam Boyd for the plaintiffs. I want to begin with Judge Newsom's question about the scope of the injunction. We certainly have understood throughout this case that the defendant's position was that Ms. Wood is restrained from speaking her pronouns to any student at any time that she's in the school. And so that includes in the hallway, it includes she interacts with a student before class while students are passing in between classes after the bell rings, and it would even include when she's speaking with a student, for example, at the stands of a football game, as in Kennedy.
I take that from the face of the statute, but I understood, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that this was an as-applied challenge with respect to classroom activity.
It's an as-applied challenge with respect to Ms. Wood's use of her pronouns at all times in the classroom. She's never limited her claim to her ability. I think we've focused on the classroom because that's the hardest case for us, and it's certainly the most contentious one. But I certainly understand the district court's injunction to bar enforcement of the statute against her at all times, not only when she's in the classroom.
So with respect to some actual facts, because it's a pre-enforcement challenge, so there's no enforcement, but am I right that in her affidavit she says, look, it is the... I want to put it on the syllabus, I want to put it on the whiteboard, classroom blackboard. I want to tell students, you know, when they use the wrong pronoun, that they're using the wrong pronoun, they got to use the right one. And then I want to wear the, I thought it was a button, but some kind of like clothing article.
It's a she, her pin, I believe, that she wears on her lanyard.
So are those the four kind of uses of this that we're talking about as far as the record goes?
Yes, those are the four that she identified. I would say she didn't limit her desire to provide her gender, her pronouns or title to students to doing so in the classroom. She might interact with a student outside of her classroom, and she would like...
Those are the examples that are in there. Is like, this is how I want to do this.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so on some of those, it just seems, and I just want you to respond to this, some of those seem very much pursuant to job responsibilities. So, for example, the syllabus. I mean, the syllabus is literally, this is what we're going to learn in this class. This is what I'm teaching you. In the classroom, I mean, the teacher is saying, you know, you raise your hand and you say, Mr., and the teacher says, no, that's wrong, Mrs. The same way if you raised your hand and said 2 + 2 = 5, the teacher says, no, that's wrong, it equals 4. How are those not pursuant to job responsibilities?
Because her pronouns and her title are not selected by her employer. So it is true that...
Well, the question in this case is whether they're going to be. So,
I mean, well, I should say, they're attempting to limit her ability to use the ones that she has selected. They haven't said, you're a woman, not a man. That was her choice, or her identity anyway. And I would also point to Kennedy's analogy to a Muslim teacher. So a Muslim teacher needs to be present in the classroom, or a Jewish teacher wearing an article of religious clothing. They're certainly present in the classroom speaking to students pursuant to their duties, and those pieces of clothing communicate a message to the students as clearly as if they said, you know, I'm Muslim, I'm Jewish, and they're doing so, you know, while they're interacting with students.
Yeah, so I think that's a stronger case for you. I guess my issue is, like I said, the syllabus, the whiteboard, the telling the student in the classroom, that's the wrong pronoun, the right pronoun is this. That seems, can you just address that? That just seems like I said, that seems pursuant to a teacher's official responsibilities.
Well, I would start with the responding to students. Ms. Wood certainly does not claim a right to, you know, require any student to call her anything. All she wants to say is, if she's asked, for example, as in Judge Jordan's hypothetical, how she would like to be referred to be able to answer. Mm-hmm. And if a student, you know, uses the wrong pronoun, which in her experience has been unintentional generally, to just say, I actually go by she, her, but that's fine. And so I think that's the same way as, you know, if a teacher was called by the wrong name, then, you know, the teacher would have the ability to correct it without their name becoming government speech. And I think if you accept that that is government speech, then you do have to accept that the answer to all of Judge Jordan's hypotheticals is that the state, in fact, can require, you know, teachers to use.
And what about going the other way? Does your position necessarily entail some goofy stuff heading in the other direction where, for instance, the state can't require honorifics or the state can't prohibit the teacher from, you know, introducing himself as Mr. MAGA or Captain Woke or whatever?
I think in all those cases could be easily handled by the remaining Pickering-Garcetti factors. So I think some of those things, not clear to me whether they would reach a topic of public concern. Maybe the MAGA one would, but there would be a very clear public interest in prohibiting that speech. So I think that sort of creative...
Well, let's just assume this. I mean, I think the most likely hypothetical is someone says, look, we have a charter school, it's a state school, we have done research and we found that schools do better when there's formality between teachers and students, and therefore we are going to require teachers to be called Mr. Johnson, Mrs. Johnson, and we're going to require the teachers to call the students the same thing. You know, you can't call them Timmy, you've got to call them like Mr. Smith, right? It seems like under your analysis, none of that is pursuant to official duties. It's all private speech.
I think a general policy of that nature, would be distinct in the sense that the government would be saying, here's the category we want you to, here's the type of address we want people to write to you. We're not picking, in that case, which title you use. We're just saying we want you to use a formal title
I get how that would be a different case on the other aspects of it. I guess I'm trying to figure out whether this is pursuant to official duties, whether it's government speech or not. It seems like you would have to say, well, none of that's government speech because it's their names. And so, it seems like your argument here is that your name and your pronouns and your title are individual to you and they are your private, that's your private speech. That's what the district court said.
I think which titles you use, which pronouns you use, those are all your private speech. But the government... could impose a general sort of policy as you use only last names or only first names for that matter. And there
it's not like your last name.
I'm sorry?
What if you don't like your last name? You don't want to be referred to by your last name.
I think in that case, that would not be private speech. That would be a sort of general policy. Did you give another analogy?
Well, I mean, here's an example. I mean, there are lots of people that don't go by their first names. They hate their first names. They go by their middle names. And what if the government said, well, no, you always have to go by your actual given legal name?
I think that might become private speech if you weren't allowing teachers, for example, to change their names or use a preferred name.
What's the criterion by which we're saying, well, that one goes over here and this one goes over there? I mean, I'm having a hard time tracking the answers to the hypos.
I think what's difficult is to sort of prevent some of the unfortunate consequences. I mean, for example, I think if we adopted the view that sort of as a general matter, whenever the government sets a broad policy, that converts it into government speech, then we would run into the problem where the government can generally set a dress code, for example, but it couldn't use the fact that, the fact that it's requiring dress code doesn't mean that the clothes that the teachers wear are private speech. I don't think you could argue that that means the government can require, all teachers to wear, to not wear head coverings, for example, and use that policy to justify prohibiting, Muslim or Jewish teachers from wearing religious head coverings. And defendants have responded in the course of their reply brief, which is the first time they've addressed this point, that, those are all handled by free exercise principles. But I don't think that's possibly right. So, for example, if a district had a blanket policy of prohibiting jewelry, I think it would go beyond the scope of their ability as an employer to say, that includes wedding rings. We're not going to allow any teacher to wear a wedding ring, even though, for non-religious reasons, some teachers believe that that conveys an important fact about their own personal identity, that they're married, that they're part of a unit. I don't think, the fact that there was sort of a blanket policy could be used to convert that decision to wear a wedding ring into government speech.
So can I ask you, the headscarf example in Kennedy, I agree, is good for you. I understand their answer is that's free exercise. Can you address for me the balance of Kennedy? I'll confess that, I think I read Kennedy when it came out, hadn't been back to it since and got to this case. And frankly, the way you briefed the case, I thought when I get to Kennedy, there's going to be a lot of good stuff in there for the challengers. And frankly, when I read it, I thought, whoa, from the very outset, the court is going to great lengths to say, hey, let's be clear. This was, although he was on duty, the coach was effectively on extra time. It wasn't sort of on the field, you know, sort of on the field during the game, wasn't at halftime. And I just kept thinking, like, boy, this case seems distinguishable in every respect, like so distinguishable that I wondered whether Kennedy might sort of boomerang back around on you and undermine your case. So can you address the sort of the above the line stuff in Kennedy, so to speak?
Certainly. I think Kennedy is, you know, analogous to our facts. Certainly she was speaking outside the classroom, although we contend that she's being limited to that. And to the extent the court feels that distinction is relevant, I would encourage it to remand, you know, with instructions to the district court to clarify the scope of its injunction. But to return to sort of the facts of Kennedy, I think, you know, he was speaking in his classroom, which was the field. The Supreme Court said that.
But, you get what I'm saying.
I do.
The very first paragraph, Justice Gorsuch is saying, let's be clear, this is when everybody else was checking phones or singing the fight song or whatever. That just seems pretty distinguishable from standing up at the front of the classroom and handing out the syllabus or writing your name on the whiteboard.
I think she's permitted to do other private speech at least some of those times. So there's no rule that we're aware of that prohibits her for example, putting her, a photo of her pet on the whiteboard or writing something about her.
The question is whether could they adopt one, right? I mean, that's the point. They don't have one yet, but they could, saying that she
don't
could,
tempt them.
Yeah.
I think that would be a harder...
To say that this doesn't exist yet doesn't mean that it's not...
Yeah, but that would be a harder case for us. I mean, the fact that they have singled out this one particular kind of speech is distinct from a situation where they've said, you know, teacher, you must come into the classroom. You may only speak on curricular topics. You may not discuss anything else. That would be, a much better set of facts for the state. But here... when it comes to the passing period, when it comes to the hallway, even when it comes to syllabus, the teacher might, I think I had a teacher who put, some of her favorite quotes on her syllabus. The government, I think, could prohibit any non-curricular speech from the syllabus, from the whiteboard, from the pin on the lanyard, but it hasn't done that. And so that would be a harder case for us, but that's, not this case.
Can you tell me why you think the district court got the speech on a matter of public concern right?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think even the defendants don't dispute that the topic of gender identity, the topic of how transgender people identify or are identified is a question of public concern. Their position is that because Ms. Wood is speaking to advance her own personal interests, that means that speech is no longer on a topic of public concern. And I think the district court correctly rejected that view. It pointed out that the fact that the state wanted to regulate this question showed how much it was of a public concern. And I would also say,
you may have some better arguments on that, but that one seems very bad because it's just very tautological. It's basically like if it's something that is subject to regulation, then it's therefore a subject, it's public concern, it can't be regulated. That doesn't make any sense.
I don't think that's a sufficient quantity, but I think it's a point in our favor, but I'll move on. I would also say, in Meriwether, the court said that what pronouns people use is clearly a topic of public concern. I think also, just in general, I think the fact that there have been so many cases before this court on transgender issues.
Here's the thing. I think the broader issue of sort of transgender rights and transgender speech and maybe even the right pronouns to use when you address other people, like, that's clearly an issue that you could, for example, had she written an op-ed, no question, right? This lawsuit, no question, right? This lawsuit is covered. But we've said that one thing we assess is whether the purpose of the employee's speech was to raise issues of public concern. And all of these cases try to draw a line between sort of an individual just engaging with people in their workplace and an individual kind of participating in the marketplace of ideas and raising issues and things like that. Why is this more on the line of kind of raising ideas and participating in the marketplace of ideas than just, look, you're in your workplace and you're making, we all talk in our workplaces about whatever. Why isn't it more like on that side of the line?
Well, I would say this court has cautioned in Mitchell and in other cases that, content is the most important question when determining the public concern prong. I would also say if, Ms. Wood's speech is not on topic of public concern, neither was Coach Kennedy's. He was praying for personal reasons. It was a private, personal prayer that he was doing for his own religious
observance. But that was stipulated in Kennedy, right?
It was, Your Honor. But I think defendants' arguments would certainly imply that he should have lost on his First Amendment claim and that anyone else who has a sort of secular version should also similarly lose. And that conclusion seems to me to be abhorrent and to kind of, render that.
Well, Snyder suggests that purpose isn't determinative in figuring out whether something is a matter of public concern or not.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? Whatever drives the individual is not the end-all, be-all of whether or not something qualifies as speech on a matter of public concern or not.
Yes, and in that case, and also Mitchell and others, even Alvis, which the defendants rely on very heavily for this motive analysis, you know, considered other factors. It only considered motive as one of several factors in the public concern analysis.
Yeah, so we've said, and the Supreme Court in Garcetti said, that you look at the content, the form, and the context. And I think you've been talking about the context, you know, sort of the broader transgender issues in the public. But it seems like the form here really, really cuts against you, because the form is just on the syllabus, on the board, on a pen. The communication goes no further than just the present people in this person's workplace. Do you have anything to say on the form?
I think there are other cases where the court has held that just communications solely to coworkers are nonetheless subject to public concern, particularly in a case as here, where we're talking about a sort of core First Amendment issue. Connick did contemplate some speech in the workplace being subject to protection. Rankin v. McPherson, that was speech just to one coworker about a matter of public concern. And the court had no difficulty in that case finding that the relevant issue was nonetheless a public concern. And I would also say, if I may finish, I see my time is expiring, ruling that this is not a matter of public concern would really have implications not just for Ms. Wood, but for anyone who wants to speak on any topic inside the workplace.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points. First, on the nature of the challenge. Before the district court, the plaintiff pressed a facial challenge to the statute. Did not press an overbreadth challenge, and Judge Walker concluded correctly that as a result, that they weren't really actually fighting about every aspect of the law, just as applied in the classroom. If you look at page 55, he concluded it was as applied based in part on Wood's concession that was the only type of speech that was at issue. So that is what we're talking about right now in classroom speech. To get to the point about, okay, maybe the whiteboard and the, I think it was Judge Brasher's point, the whiteboard, the syllabus, speaking to students, maybe that's government speech, but not the pen. This court held in Abdur Rahim that if you're slicing and dicing the speech that way is not how the Garcetti analysis works. And so I would suggest that would be slicing and dicing in a way this court has said is not the way to do it. I do want to talk about Kennedy and the Muslim headscarf example. I think it's an important issue. I think the only way to read that part of the opinion is that it is in part grounded in free exercise. At the beginning of the decision, as Judge Newsom pointed out, there was a lot of discussion about what the nature of that case was. And one of the things is that religious speech is doubly protected under the free exercise clause and the free speech clause. And the problem with Kennedy was that everyone was free to engage in secular speech. But Kennedy himself was not allowed to engage in religious speech, and that had things backwards, if anything. So the hypothetical here is not whether a Muslim teacher is wearing a headscarf. It's whether every teacher can wear a Make America Great Again or a Vote for Harris hat, and the Muslim teacher cannot wear the headscarf. It's the inversion of how my friend uses it. And I do want to talk about...
But the fact, to push back a little bit on your contention that religious speech is doubly protected, that's not always true. So if the Florida Department of Education decided you can't talk about religion in the classroom, your argument would be that that's okay.
Maybe under the free speech clause, but there would still be a free exercise component.
Oh, so you can proselytize to students.
Oh, I'm sorry. Judge Jordan, I misunderstood your hypothetical.
Right. It's not always doubly protected. Context and circumstance matter.
Of course.
Because the state of Florida could pass a law, if it doesn't already have one, that says you can't preach religion to your students in the classroom. And even though that would be religious speech in a public setting, you would think that the state of Florida can prohibit that.
I think that's right. That's
religious
what's happening
in nature.
I think if you looked at Kennedy, if Kennedy was, I mean, the court made very clear in Kennedy that he was not instructing players, discussing strategy, encouraging on-field performance. If you're in the locker room, if he's in the locker room saying, this is how we're going to beat our rival, now let me lead you all in prayer, I think Kennedy might actually come out differently. And just to conclude, if I could, the line that's drawn in this case, in this statute, is the exact line that the Supreme Court has drawn, which is public employees need to, just because they become public employees doesn't mean they lose their rights to advocate publicly. Wood can write letters to the editor, post on social media, and there's and the schools cannot do anything to prevent that. On the other hand, public employers, just because they're public employers, don't lose the right to regulate their workplace. And so we think this law actually draws the exact line, because Wood can still go out and advocate on whatever issue that Wood would like to do.
All right. Thank you both very much. All right. We're in recess until tomorrow.
All rise.